Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Well, the results are in on this day after election night. Utah will have mostly Republican representation in its House and Senate, as well as statewide offices, continuing what has gone on before. Former President Trump is president-elect. He will indeed poll at Grover Cleveland, and Republicans will control the U.S. Senate. The U.S. House of Representatives is yet to be decided. We're going to recap the 2024 election with USU political science professor Damon Kahn. Damon Kahn, you were with us late last night, with us now this morning. Thank you so much.
Glad to be back again.
Hopefully you got a little bit of sleep.
Yes.
We're going to ask you what you think and how you're feeling. Day after, if you're a Democrat, probably not real happy. Republican, probably happy. What do you think about all of this, and how are you going to go forward? I guess if you're a Democrat, what's especially I'm very interested because I have a lot of Democratic friends who feel like for 9 years I've been holding the line on democracy, right? That's been a big issue for them, and now what do you do? Do you continue to give that body English every day, that tension every day for another 4 years, or you kind of retreat? I've heard from some of my friends that's kind of what they're planning on doing, kind of just stepping back a bit.
I think at times everyone needs to take moments where they're deeply engaged in politics, and everyone needs to take a breather now and again. But I think that the nature of our system and the genius of what the founders did when they crafted the Constitution and the changes we've seen in the system over time are to create a system of separation of powers, of checks and balances. And, Republicans, hats off to you, to President Trump. Congratulations on a successful election at the presidential level. And Democrats, keep in mind that this is a system with checks and balances. And in the end, there are always times and resources built into the system where people who may not have won a majority in a presidential election still have ways to express their preferences, have their voices heard. Governors. You've got states that are going to be controlled by Democrats. You're going to have, while you'll have a majority in the Senate on the Republican side, the filibuster, at least for now, is present and works to incentivize a system where people strive to build consensus, work together, and find solutions that work for a broad spectrum of the American people. That is part of the genius of the system. That's not to say to take anything away from Trump in his successful election, nor to take anything from Biden in his successful election 4 years ago. But it's just the nature of the way the system works, and it gives us a robustness. It protects us from tyranny of the majority. It protects us from the mischiefs of faction, and hopefully leads to good outcomes for the American people.
So, Damon, you've made me feel good. Let me, and hopefully our listeners as well, let me depress them again with some arguments on the other side. I think a lot of Democrats would say, yes, understand everything you just said. But Supreme Court, essentially, from the Democrats' point of view, has given the president a carte blanche. Total immunity. Some would quibble with that. President Trump has talked about, I don't know whether he'll follow through, he has talked about using the Department of Justice to go after his political enemies. This is a president who did not accept a previous election, right? That's not to say this election wasn't totally legitimate. It looks like he's won a sweeping victory here.
Sure.
Now, he will be 82 at the end of the... there are worries, what's going to happen. In other words, those guardrails you talked about, checks and balances, from the point of view of a lot of Democrats, have been kind of eaten away over time, and now maybe that accelerates.
Yeah, you know, the Supreme Court gave broad immunity for official acts of a president. The Supreme Court hasn't ruled yet on what constitutes how we distinguish right. between an official act and an act that is not an official act of the president. I think many of the legal cases that are that have been proceeding against Trump are likely to largely grind to a halt at this point. I think, though, that thinking about what the composition of the Supreme Court looks like moving forward, if I'm not mistaken, I think the two oldest justices are Justice Thomas and Justice Alito, who tend to fall on the conservative end of the judicial spectrum. And so I don't think you'll see, you know, growth during President Trump's second term here. I don't think you'll see an expansion of the conservative majority on the court. I think you will see, possibility of replacements for those two justices in the next 4 years. And I think you'll see, likely not see other changes in the staffing of the court. And so more of the, I don't think you'll see a further right push in the way that court is staffed.
Well, let's we invite you to call us. We want to know how you're feeling here. 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495 to give us a call. So let's start with the state level. Looks like things have gone pretty much how you might have predicted, right? On the the federal the statewide races. Have been swept by Republicans, by and large by healthy majorities.
Yeah, President Trump, is coming in the high 50s in Utah. In the pre-Trump elections, you'd often expect to see Republicans coming in at 60% plus. Still a little bit of hesitancy in some components of the Utah Republican Party for Donald Trump. That said, Trump seems to be improving and building on his level of support in the state of Utah with each continuing election that he's been involved in. But all four House races are easy victories for the Republicans seeking those offices. John Curtis, was one of the first calls in the state of Utah after polls closed, winning over 60% of the vote. The statewide race that I think was maybe getting the most attention in the run up to election night was the governor's race, where you had Phil Lyman, who had won at convention, the Republican Party convention, but then lost in the primary election. Had it not been for the signature path, Spencer Cox would have been eliminated at convention. And yet, when time rolls around to the general election, he wins by over 10 points. I think it shows that Cox really does have a good pulse on the attitudes and beliefs of Utahns. When it comes down to it in the general election, the vast majority of Republicans and some Democrats wanted to support Spencer Cox. With Republicans, notwithstanding whatever went down at the convention, coming around and saying Cox is our nominee, we're going to support him. And, on the one hand, I want to, Phil Lyman performing at 8% in a writing mm-hmm. campaign is a pretty impressive result
right. yeah.
For a writing candidate. But that said, it was nowhere near what he would have needed to achieve to win the race or even split enough of the Republican vote off to make Cox vulnerable to a loss by a Democratic challenger.
And it appears that Republican leaders, you said House and Senate, et cetera, were not willing to play ball with Representative Lyman in terms of his accusations and
Not
and
at
wishes.
All. In fact, there was a lot of hostility. I think Lyman burned a lot of bridges with some of his colleagues, soon to be former colleagues in the Utah legislature, by continuing to not only throw mud in Cox's direction, but even to begin criticizing the legislature for doing things that he himself had voted for as a member of the legislature. And I think there's a lot of lost patience on the part of legislative leadership and Mr. Lyman.
So if you look at House and Senate races in Utah, again, I think mostly going to form. One I'll bring up is Patrick Belmont's race as an independent here in Cache Valley. Very, very, very vigorous race.
Yeah, I mean, both Patrick Belmont and Jason Thompson, I think, spent a lot of time out there. A lot of shoe leather wearing down on the sidewalks of Logan City in that race over the course of the election. Patrick's bid was novel for his candidacy as an independent, where he'd previously run as a Democrat. But in the end, I think there was a trade-off with that strategy. On the one hand, there might be some people who were willing to cross over and vote for Patrick Belmont as an independent that wouldn't have wanted to go all the way and vote for a Democrat. On the flip side, I think you're probably going to have some voters, some Democrats, who looked at that race, maybe didn't get touched by campaign stimulus, and just skipped voting in it because they looked at that race and didn't see someone with their party identification as a candidacy. Overall, it looks like those effects were probably a wash, as vote total is very similar in the 2024 election to where it came in 2022.
So, United Utah Party continues to field candidates. There's now a Utah Forward Party, which is, I think, is a kind of a centrist party as well. Other so-called third parties. But I don't know. I guess our system is just such that it's very hard to gain traction as a third party, isn't it?
It definitely is. One of my favorite examples of this out of this election cycle is the Utah Attorney General's race. You have Michelle Quist running as the United Utah Party candidate. She has better name recognition than the average third party candidate. She's worked as a journalist. She's worked previously in Republican Party politics before stepping over to the United Utah Party, and has some visibility and name recognition. She outspent the Democratic candidate for Attorney General by a very substantial margin. She was traveling the state. She was campaigning. I don't recall seeing a single Rudy Bautista sign, the Democratic nominee for that race, in the last several months. But I saw Michelle Quist signs in a number of places. And notwithstanding the fact that she spent more and campaigned harder and went after this election much more aggressively than the Democratic nominee did, party identification has a strong influence on the way people choose to vote. There's some set of people that are just going to vote their party no matter what else is going on. And that shows that in spite of a well-run campaign by a third-party candidate, Michelle Quist, she comes out just under 7% of the vote in returns that we have in so far, while Rudy Bautista is in the neighborhood, just shy of 30%. So it's just a tough slog if you don't have an R or a D next to your name.
Yeah. Well, and in most cases, an R, right? So that's where I want to go next.
In Utah, for sure.
In Utah, for sure. Very red state. What do you think is behind that? I think I've been alive long enough. I was alive for this shift. 70s especially seemed to be social issues that that shifted the state, and it's never looked back. It's to this day solidly Republican.
Yeah, I think social cultural issues. Utah is a much more socially orthodox state than most. The strong influence of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is likely to be a part of that story. Although, curiously, relative to other Christian faiths that tend to skew Republican, Latter-day Saints have tended to be a little more tepid towards Trump over the last several election cycles. That notwithstanding, they've continued to be pretty solidly Republican in their orientation. A lot of cultural, social type issues that I think are the underpinning for the success of the Republican Party in Utah.
So results here. Last night, you and I, Damon, talked with Senator-elect John Curtis. One of the issues that he brought up was civility. And I don't know, I wonder what your thoughts. And, you know, and I asked him, would you, do you think you'll be able to get that done? And how accommodationist will you have to be with President Trump? And he said, well, I support him on issues we agree with and don't support him on issues I don't agree with. But I guess just overall civility, do you think, are you hopeful of moving them more in that direction or continue acrimonious?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the personalities of our elected leaders. You know, we have some individuals in the Utah Republican Party who've really preached a lot of civility. John Curtis is among them. Spencer Cox had a tremendous pressure from some of his campaign advisors to go negative against Phil Lyman and really try to shore up his support. But Governor Cox was in the middle of the Disagree Better initiative in his chairmanship of the National Governors Association, and it didn't feel to him like the right time. I think the fact that he stepped back when he was getting people pushing him to go in that direction shows that he does strive. You know, critics will say certainly imperfectly, and that's fair. But he does strive to practice what he preaches on that front. That said, civility has not been Donald Trump's strong suit, and I think we're going to see. Continue to see a lot of conflict and negativity in the nature of dialogue that we see in our national politics in the years ahead, because the head of the executive office tends to do a lot to set the tone of what politics looks like by the kind of discourse they engage in.
Yeah. By the way, President Trump will, I think, be the oldest president ever. I'm not sure on inauguration day, but certainly by the end of his term. I mean, kudos to J.D. Vance. That you could say it crass, cynical. All of those are certainly, valid charges. But for an ambitious young man, and he's still very young, Vice President of the United States to a very old president.
Yeah, I think we've seen, while we haven't seen very many vice presidents become presidents in the last, 45 years, through the broader arc of our country's history, it's actually been not uncommon to see vice presidents ascend to the office of the presidency. And with Trump being a little bit older, I certainly think that there's an elevated possibility of J.D. Vance coming into that position. One of the early occupants of the vice presidency, spoke of the office and its significance by saying, "My country has contrived for me." Or has created for me the most insignificant office ever the mind of man contrived. Vice presidents really matter primarily because they could become president if something happens to the president. Beyond that, a vice president only matters to the extent that the president wants them to matter. And while J.D. Vance may have some roles to play in working in the Senate with legislative relations or just as an alternative spokesperson, Trump's style has always been that he is front and center, and I don't see any reason that that's going to change during the course of his presidency.
Let's head toward a break. I want to know what you're thinking and feeling in the aftermath of this election. Results are mostly in. 800-826-1495 is the number you can call us. 800-826-1495. 800-826-1495. Or you can email me to upraxcess@gmail.com. upraxcess@gmail.com. More on this election recap with USU political science professor Damon Kahn following this break. Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. It's the day after the big election day in 2024. We're recapping the election with USU political science professor Damon Kahn. I would love to know what you think, what you're thinking, what you're feeling in the aftermath of this election. You can call us to 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, or you can email me to upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. So, Damon, I want to talk about polling. I haven't looked up the exact margins, and I guess we probably won't know the total exact margins for the states that have swing states that have been called, you know, Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. But on the basis of that, former President Trump is president-elect. But it seems like a miss. I guess maybe pollsters would say, well, we margin of error. Some of these states are within the margin of error, which I guess that's a good defense.
Yeah, sure. There definitely were many of the states that are within the margin of error. I mean, when a poll is predicting that someone has 50.3% of the vote and their opponent has 49.7% of the vote, then, you know, and any amount of variation, including natural variation that we expect to see in polls, will be present. The thing that's surprising, in the days leading up to the election, there were narratives emerging that some people felt like pollsters were trying really hard to maybe even intentionally overcount Republican votes, and reading into that a 50-50 forecast, that a veritable tie, almost certainly meant that if pollsters were making such a concerted effort not to undercount Republicans and Trump supporters specifically, in ways that they had done in the last two presidential election cycles, that it must mean that Trump was actually winning. And it turned out that even with pollsters making every effort to potentially even overcount Republicans, that they still ended up undercounting Trump supporters in the electorate. And so I think the take-home lesson, given that this is Trump's last election cycle under our constitutional rules, is that we just never figured out how to really accurately poll when Trump was on the ballot. In our midterm elections, we've done much better. And regular Republicans haven't been the same challenge to poll, but there's something about Donald Trump and his appeal, the way he is able to motivate turnout among otherwise low propensity voters, is just different than what we've seen before, and we just haven't figured out how to capture that in our polling work.
Why do you think that is? Why have pollsters had such a hard time?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of possibilities, but you know, the biggest one that stands out to me, the hazard of polling is that you're sampling from an unknown population. We can do polling with random sampling really well if we know that we have a group of 1,000 people. We can randomly select from within those 1,000 people and choose 100 of them, and we can get really good representative results of the overall 1,000 from the 100 that we choose, because we know who the 1,000 are. The challenge of election polling is that you're sampling from an unknown population, because you don't know who's going to vote until after they've already voted. And so I think the challenge of polling Trump has been that there's something different about what motivates turnout and what the composition of the electorate looks like when he is on the ballot than what we have seen with the typical candidate otherwise. And I think this effort to model the electorate and say, well, it'll look more or less like what turned out 4 years ago, has just not been a successful strategy for pollsters.
Now, some political scientists say campaigns don't matter as much as we think they do, that it's the fundamentals. And you could certainly make an argument for that. That you could certainly say this election is a data point, for that argument. Yeah. What do you think?
With everything else going on, if you look at the fundamental question as Ronald Reagan would have posed it in 1980 is, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And if the exit polls show that individuals who feel like they are much worse off or even just slightly worse off, which make up a sizable majority of the country, broke very heavily for Trump in this election. And so yes, that aspect of fundamentals, you know, some people said this election would be about abortion, you know, a review of the Dobbs decision and Trump's court appointments. Some people said that it might be a referendum on democracy. And at the end of the day, the issue that seems to have most heavily motivated voters was how they feel about economic performance from the last 4 years. And in that respect, things had not gone well under the Biden administration.
Yeah.
So that certainly stands out. You know, there. That said, the flip side of the fundamentals is that incumbents usually win. I guess we didn't have Joe Biden on the ballot so Harris wasn't a true incumbent, even though she was the incumbent president's party. And that may have ended up being a little bit of a liability for Democrats, notwithstanding questions and concerns about President Biden's age.
By the way, back to the polls. For those of us who've been on the roller coaster for the past, however many months, I don't know, maybe the, you know, and presumably Mr. Trump will not run again. And so maybe polling will get back to being a little more accurate. But I guess if you're living and dying by polls, that's just not a good way to live emotionally.
Yeah, you know, the saying in politics is that the only poll that matters is election day, and that certainly proves to be true here. You know, it's there's other challenges to polling. You've got declining response rates, fewer and fewer people. You know, when we started doing telephone polls, you know, 40, 50, 60 years ago. You could get 30-40% of the people, maybe even more than that, who you called to answer the phone and felt like it was a great opportunity to make their voice heard when a pollster called them. Today, people don't answer the phone if they don't recognize it, and telephone polling has just become more and more difficult to do. The advent of cell phones make things a little bit trickier. It's still manageable. We made some good strides there. But as fewer and fewer people answer phones to participate in the polls, it becomes more difficult and we have to rely on corrections and on the assumption that the people who do answer the phone are similar in other respects to those who don't. And that might be another piece of the puzzle of on the Trump phenomenon, because in his case, that just may not be true.
By the way, the famous Seltzer poll, the Iowa poll, which gave Democrats so much hope in the concluding days of the election, Ann Seltzer had Harris up 3 in Iowa. She said this might be an outlier, right? And she doesn't wait or anything. She just puts the poll out there. This appears to be been another miss for her. That's 2 in the last 20 years, so it's still a pretty good track record, right? But it appears to have been a miss.
Yeah. You know, and one of the interesting things about this election cycle where we're talking about polling is that we did see a substantial amount of herding. Herding is the phenomenon that we've seen in presidential elections past, but clearly present in a strong way in this cycle, whereas the election gets close to its end, pollsters start looking at everybody else's poll results and trying to reweight their polls so they look like everybody else's, because nobody wants to be that one outlier that gets it wrong. But the reality is that polls have sampling error. If you grab one sample of 500 people, they're going to look different than sometimes in substantial ways than a different sample of 500 people. And every pollster, no matter how good, if they're honest in their results, and not trying to engage in these kinds of herding behaviors, is going to, from time to time, have outliers. We should expect to see some polls that are just kind of different from all the others. In fact, 5% of polls should be outside the margin of error, because these margins that are used are 95% confidence intervals, the way we approach them statistically. And so we should see that. And what we ended up seeing is very few of those, other than Ms. Seltzer's poll in Iowa, far fewer than we would have expected by random chance. And so We know hurting goes on. We know it's gone on in many election cycles. The bias is usually towards just making the election look a little closer than it actually is. So that, and everybody kind of formulates around a consensus. And in this case, the consensus was around 50-50 for the overall probability of winning elections. Several states, though, had a little bit of understatement, especially some of these swing states came closer to 50-50 and understated Trump's true level of support in those states.
If you just joined us, we're talking with USU political science professor Damon Kahn. We're recapping the 2024 election. The results are mostly in. Some states we don't have full results in, but enough have been called to make former President Trump the president-elect. U.S. Senate will be Republican. Right now, I think it's 52-48. I don't know if there's
I think we got a 53. I think we had one
53.
More called.
Okay, yeah. And the House still a bit up in the air. It's probably going to be close either way. I want to talk about issues, starting with Utah. We talked with several candidates last night, Damon Kahn. I know one issue that kept coming up in just about everybody we talked with, whether it be Republican, Democrat, or Independent, was housing. That seems to be a top issue. You talk to people, that is a top issue.
Yeah, absolutely. The housing, if housing were an easy issue to solve, we would have fixed it a long time ago. The fundamental underlying issue at the moment is that demand for housing outstrips supply of housing. Utah's seen very substantial population growth. The largest share of it comes from within. Utahns are known as a state that loves big families, and we pride ourselves on being a state that's a great place for to raise children. And then we also have, positive net in migration, many more people coming into the state of Utah than are leaving. And, strong economic performance in the state is a part of that, job opportunities and the like. But along with that kind of success comes more demand for being able to be here. And at the moment, that's led to a housing crunch. It's not just in migration or large families, though. The cost of building materials and supplies has been hit hard by inflation over the last several years. And so along with general demand factors, you also have increases in the price of goods, and that's a recipe for expensive housing.
Any other issues that stood out to you as we talked to those candidates last night?
I think housing was kind of one of the bigger ones. We had several of our local candidates talk about their hopes for being able to support Utah State University in their representation efforts. I think that's very positive. A lot of discussion about job creation, economic, inflation has, loomed large in the presidential election, but we heard several of the candidates we spoke with last night talking about that and trying to find ways to help Utah families be successful, economically speaking. But a lot of the levers for that lie at the federal rather than at the state level. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see what kinds of things the state tries to do in addition to any changes we see at the federal level.
I recall State Senator Wilson talked about traffic. So that's an ongoing problem. I think many see that in Logan and Cache Valley.
Yes. And really, if you look at the issues locally in Cache Valley, and like many of the communities in Utah, a lot of the local issues politically all really revolve around growth, population growth, whether it's fueled from within or from net immigration to the state of Utah. When you think about water, water is a growth issue because we have more people and we have a fixed supply of water or perhaps even a slightly declining amount of water. If you think about transportation tends to be a growth-related issue because we had the roads that we needed to be successful 10, 20 years ago, but do we have the roads, the public transportation, the other infrastructure we need to be successful moving forward? Transportation and infrastructure becomes a growth issue. Housing is a growth issue. And so many of the pressures that we face in many of Utah's communities, both locally here in Cache Valley and across the state, are related to growth.
One issue going back nationally, one thing that John Curtis's win here in the Senate means is, I assume he'll be taking his work on climate change to the Senate now.
Yeah, I you know, it was a really curious thing. You know, in the primary election, Curtis had you know, I think you know, the strategy at this point we can say was successful, given that he's been elected to the Senate. You know, he did make sure that he hit notes that were important for core conservatives in terms of talking about immigration. He spent some time talking about gun rights, Second Amendment stuff. But then he also chose not to hide from his position on climate, but even in the primary election to embrace it and to encourage people to think about energy strategies, you know, hosting a Conservative Climate Solutions conference. And really making that a core part of the kinds of issues he's trying to address. And if you do that, you know, if you're going to make climate a centerpiece of a Republican primary election, it's hard to imagine it's not going to be a part of the kinds of things he does during the course of his service in the Senate over the next 6 years.
Yeah, I was quite impressed with his primary campaign, at least with the television ads that I was seeing. I've known him as kind of moderate, maybe because of his views on climate change, which don't jibe with many Republican colleagues. But those ads were all guns and close the border and
I think. You know, when we talk about moderates, a lot of times what we mean is someone who is either conservative or pretty conservative or pretty liberal on the vast majority of issues, and they'll choose one or two issues that that are, for whatever reason, are very important to them, that they really believe in, but that might not be right where the bulk of the rest of their party is at. And I think that's the case for John Curtis. It's hard to make the case that he's not conservative on immigration or on guns or a variety of related issues. You know, his social issue positions have been fairly conservative as well. But you'll find on several issues that he's someone who's very pragmatic. He's a kind of elected official who would rather get something done that might not be quite what he wanted than insist that nothing happens unless he gets exactly what he wants. And that's part of the reason why he's been, as effective of a lawmaker as he has been in the House. And we'll see what life looks like as a junior senator for a senator-elect Curtis. That's tends to be a tough go for most people for their first several years in the Senate. But I think over time he'll bring that same work ethic and the same set of goals to the Senate that he displayed in the House.
By the way, the senior senator Mike Lee appears to have, you know, placed a good bet. I bet that makes it sound cynical. I think he's become a true believer. I think he is a true supporter of Trumpism and Mr. Trump. But now he'll, I think, have the president's ear and have access to power.
I think so. That certainly seems to have been the objective. Controversially, Mike Lee was, engaged in some text threads and conversations that became public during the transition of power in the 2020 election cycle, and during that time, clearly Senator Lee was hoping to have the ear of the president trying to engage with him, and I think Senator Lee will be well positioned to be part of one of President Trump's go-to people in the legislature as Trump looks to figure out how to move a legislative agenda going into his second term.
Let's take another break. We're talking with USU political science professor Damon Kahn. We're recapping the 2024 election, and we'll have more following this. Thanks for joining us today for Access U. Tom Williams. We're recapping the 2024 election. Most of the results are in. Damon Kahn is a political science professor at Utah State University. Damon, that's a bit of a surprise. Based on 2020, I thought we wouldn't have presidential results till Thursday, Saturday. We've got them. I don't know when it was called last night. I was sleeping, but then I got up this morning and it was races called.
Yeah, in the 2020 election, we had a lot of states that were adapting to large-scale absentee or wholesale vote by mail elections for the first time. And we've seen a lot of states really improve on their election administration practices to be able to deliver these a little more rapidly. But notwithstanding all of the efforts, the really impressive efforts that county clerks and election administrators around the country have made to try to improve the speed of delivery of results. At the end of the day, it also just so happens that the pattern of votes that the American people delivered was a pattern of votes that made, with our electoral college system, this election much easier to discern than it might have looked like it could have been, even on the morning of the election.
I don't know. We probably don't know right now who's going to win the popular vote. And in a way, it doesn't matter at this point, right, because we have the Electoral College system, and President Trump is president-elect here because he's won, those swing states so far. Michigan still to be called, Arizona, Nevada. But I'm guessing there will be at least some Democrats continuing their call to abolish the Electoral College, because if President-elect Trump wins this election without the popular vote, that'll be three times Republicans have won the presidency without winning the popular vote in the last 20 years. Very, very hard to change the Electoral College, though.
Yeah, the popular vote from returns we have so far are shaping up such that it's likely today, and in spite of what polls probably would have predicted yesterday, it looks like Trump is likely to finish with a majority of the popular vote. Potentially even by 3-4% margin. And I think that'll mute to some extent these concerns. So he'll kind of follow the Bush pattern of losing the popular vote, but winning the Electoral College, and then eventually in a later election, winning not only in the Electoral College but also securing a plurality of the popular vote. It will, I think, raise calls and concerns. I mean, we went 100 years, over 100 years between, before President Bush, that you go back in history before you find another president who's won the popular vote or lost the popular vote but won the election. And now we have it twice in the span of 20 years. And a time here in this election cycle where it looked like we were going to come close to that, but not quite what the outcome, at least at the moment, looks like it's going to be. That said, we have governing documents in our country. The Constitution is clear, and the Constitution is not easy to change. And so, as a result, I think it's not likely that we'll see a serious conversation about abolishing the Electoral College at the moment. At the point where any party feels like it is advantaged by the Electoral College, that party will be very, very hesitant to step away from a system that they see as helping them. And at the moment, the Republicans, I think, feel like the Electoral College has been helpful to their case, given that they've been successful in winning two Electoral College elections without winning the popular vote. It's hard to know what the counterfactual looks like, because you run a campaign very differently when you're trying to win states and win the Electoral College vote than you would even run a campaign in the absence of the Electoral College, if we just had a national popular vote election. There's a lot of hunches about who would benefit and how things would change and who would have more campaign attention and all of those kinds of things that are really interesting conversations to have. But for the moment, it's just not going to be politically viable, I think, to go through the broad consensus that you would need for constitutional change or any of the other avenues people have looked at for reforming the Electoral College.
We do have a caller on the line, Jennifer in Vernal. Jennifer, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just sent my granddaughter a text message, and I said, "This is how democracies die. Willfully ignorant people with no critical thinking skills make choices based on bad information and vote against their best interests. And the pattern is so blatantly obvious that if people don't study history, numerous historians have said, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Starting with the Powell Memorandum, ages and eight. I never did like Lewis Powell. He always creeped me out. But anyway, the idea was to make sure that mostly white, almost invariably rich, quote, conservative men, in order to maintain power over all the other groups, have to make sure that they appeal to the worst in the electorate, which they've successfully done. And for people to think that it's worth, you know, we paid 12 3/4 interest on our mortgage. Okay. There was inflation during the Carter administration, but we didn't think that that was justification to tear down the entire Democratic Republic. You know, just this is selling yourself for a mess of pottage. You think by voting for Trump, you're going to get, cheaper gas prices, lower food prices, but how is he going to deport all these people and you still be able to afford a tomato? It's infuriating. And I woke up, I took a sleeping pill last night, and I woke up so sick I can't leave the house. You know, your gut is your second brain. But I don't think I've ever been this disappointed in the American public. Nobody listens to David K. Johnston out here. Nobody listens to Timothy Snyder out here, or Ann Applebaum, or that historian, or any of these people who know what they're talking about. They don't even listen to Trump's niece and nephew. So it's willful ignorance, and it goes against everything that's taught in the 13 Articles of Faith. And I've never been this disappointed. I'm so upset. Never been this disappointed in my whole life. So there's my comment. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks for sharing. I appreciate that. I'm guessing that Jennifer represents many, many people this morning. It's for millions of people. Very, very disappointing. And sick to their stomach, I think, is how millions of people will be feeling.
Yeah, we take politics very seriously. People are invested. And I think it's a good thing when people are paying attention carefully and closely following elections and developing strong feelings about candidates. We certainly want to respect people's deeply held beliefs on that front. And I think certainly a lot of people feel the same way. There's also a sizable number of people who wake up this morning as excited as can be. And I think the message I would encourage is for people to look after themselves, look after people they care about, and to strive to act with kindness and appreciation, greeting others' viewpoints with curiosity and respect rather than with contempt. Even at moments where this is deeply challenging for us, because to feel and to engage with, because if we fail to be able to relate and engage with each other, then we really are tugging at a core underpinning of being able to have something that unites us together as a society. That's a hard. That's not to say it's not a bitter, bitter pill for people to swallow. And if the election outcome were just a little bit different, then you would have millions of people on the other side feeling that same kind of exhaustion, fatigue, disappointment, and confusion about what happens. It's just part of the nature of politics.
I do think that a little bit extra here on the Democrat side, because they, I think many Democrats really did feel, do feel, this was an existential test of democracy and that the people have failed that test. So extra angst, I think, this time around.
I think that's definitely true. And folks who feel that way have good reason, have very deeply held beliefs and good reason and well-founded thoughts for those concerns. So, again, be kind to each other. Let's support each other, lift each other. After any party loses an election, there's a lot of feelings of frustration, a lot of feelings of anxiety. And hopefully, as parties have done many times in the past, you can have a moment of introspection, figure out how to sharpen the argument and come back and protect those same ideas and values that you care about so deeply, and be ready to make that argument more sharply, more effectively, and in the next election cycle, because that's the best avenue we have for expressing our opinions and steering the ship of government.
Good place to end the show, and we're out of time anyway. So Damon Cann, USU political science professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to Access Utah. Thanks.